right now, it is time for History Matters, taking a look back at this week in history with the magnificent Scott Washington, who joins us here now in the studio.
Yes, here in sunny England. I just feel cooler and calmer suddenly.
Sunny
already.
England is an oxymoron,
yes,
isn't it?
Like, I think
doesn't
that's
it always
right.
rain there?
I think, well, it's probably sunny. So I think Europe has had that heat wave, so I
oh,
don't
that's
know.
True, yeah. It's also the case that you've got the Wimbledon tennis tournament going on.
That's
and,
true.
You know, as rainy as England is purported to be, they always
yeah.
manage to get that tournament
they
in.
They always do on
two
clay
weeks
courts.
Outdoors.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, you know, when we think about history today, I think the timing of this particular day is more appropriate because 42 years ago, on this day in 1977, someone began broadcasting and has been broadcasting here at WCHL ever since and going strong. I don't know who that is.
Oh, you've got all of the information except
yeah,
for the name.
Just the name.
Today
right.
is Ron's anniversary.
That's right. Yep. Ron Stutz. Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's a kind of incredible milestone. And you have a few years on him too, don't you?
I'm catching up. Yeah. As it turns out, I'm not catching up at all. But you know,
well,
percentage-wise,
you know,
I'm getting
you
closer.
Think about 1977. If we want to talk about history, say that was pre-internet days. Those were still the rotary phone. That was.
That was pre-me.
yeah. I mean,
not
I,
by much, but by a little
chair.
Bit.
I remember yeah. when. Those were the Carter years. Oh my gosh. That, yeah. Well, that just kind of puts.
There's a really brief window.
Yeah, right? But Ron's been here through all these different decades of real change, real historic, and now he's actually become part of history himself.
Absolutely.
With that, which is a great thing. Also, now just coincidentally on this date, I don't think he planned to start on this date, but 1804, of course, is when Aaron Burr and Hamilton have that duel. Now, can you explain why this happened? A vice president of the United States is fighting an arch rival with a duel of pistols, and there's a fatality involved.
Because they're both jerks, Scott. I don't want to summarize the whole exchange, but they are both very prickly individuals
they
who are very quick to anger
and they have a lifelong antipathy towards each other, don't they?
Kind of, sort of, yeah. No, I mean, they were back and forth. It wasn't like the musical where they're, you know, constantly yeah. running into each other and hanging out at the bars all the time. But, yeah, they knew each other. They knew of each other. They hung out. But the antipathy really began in the late 1790s, early 1800s, and it really starts with Alexander Hamilton. Neither of these. So they
is
had.
Is it like the musical? Had, that's what people want to. They're listening right now, going, "Is it like the musical?"
They had personality flaws. Let's put it that way. They were very ambitious. They were very kind of very protective of their reputations. They were very, and I think Burr as well, in spite of what the musical says. Hamilton's absolutely were very quick to speak, and they didn't always speak with the most tact, or act with the most tact. And Hamilton certainly criticizing Aaron Burr, very rightly so, for trying to sneak his way into the presidency. Hamilton comes out against that, and that's kind of decisive in getting Jefferson elected, even though Hamilton hated Jefferson too. Hamilton didn't like a whole lot of people. Hamilton and Washington had this great relationship all the way through the 1780s and 1790s, and as far as I know, that's the only guy that Hamilton actually liked. Or vice versa, I'm not sure. Because Hamilton didn't like Jefferson, Hamilton didn't like Madison, Hamilton didn't like Adams, Hamilton didn't like Burr. The personal relationships yes. between all of these yes. guys.
We esteem we call them the founding fathers, but actually they're just at each other's throats
yeah.
all the time.
Like Adams and Jefferson have this fantastic relationship of in the 1770s, they were
right.
close. Adams was kind of like a father figure, older brother figure. They're
yes.
close to the 1780s. And then they have a falling out in the 1790s. They fall back in late in life. John Adams and Benjamin Franklin
yes.
are together in France
this
trying to
so
negotiate the French assistance in the Revolutionary War. And they get on each other's nerves nonstop, which is particularly hilarious because it's the 1700s, so they have to share a bed, which... maximizes the difficulty
those
there.
Those two, I can't even imagine.
Right? Because Adams was this very kind of stodgy, moralistic, very upstanding man, and he could not stand Benjamin Franklin, who was out carousing with the ladies every single night. Meanwhile, Benjamin Franklin is like, I'm out carousing with the ladies every single night because it's France and that's what you do as a diplomat. What are you doing, Adams?
Right.
And they're at each other's throats. So Hamilton says something that ticks Burr off, and Burr doesn't take that lightly, and he responds to Hamilton, and they have this very fun passive-aggressive exchange of letters where each one just escalates and escalates and escalates. We've all been in this situation where we start a conversation with someone. Maybe it's a misunderstanding. Maybe we just, like, escalate a little
something
bit because they get on
Facebook,
each other's nerves.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, right.
And then all of a sudden you're exchanging pistols at dawn, right?
Well, it's an unusual way to be remembered, and I it's also the date when "In God We Trust" becomes the motto that appears on all the currency as of 1955. I don't think any of these are necessarily related, but it's kind of fun. It would be like an improv. Okay, put these together.
How does this connect to
starting
that?
And Aaron Burr and "In God We Trust." So it's interesting. Also, this on this same date, the Marine Corps is established. On Thursday.
This is also today in history?
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
In 1798.
The Marine Corps is established in 1798, and that
it's
like
really
gets everyone
the
in the
that's right.
Right. Gets everyone in the mode of kind of that martial spirit and defending like your honor.
Yes.
And that makes Aaron Burr think I have to defend my honor. And then they challenge each other, and people are like, oh, no, we've got the vice president and the secretary of the treasury shooting each other at dawn. We've got to do something about this. We need more religion in this country, so they have "In God We Trust" stamped on all of the coins.
You're doing a fantastic job. Well, then I'll throw another one out. Apparently in 1892, same date, July 11th, I mean, was really interesting.
Clearly.
The U.S. Patent Office declares that Joseph Wilson Swan of England had invented the carbon filament used in incandescent lamps a year before Thomas Edison, which I'm thinking, what? Where did I not hear this before? That's unusual.
So what did Edison do?
He kept claiming credit.
Oh, okay, good.
That's what we still think of today. We don't think of Swan any other way. It's like the fellow who on July 8th, 1831, he was born. His name is John Stith, or Stith, S-T-Y-T-H.
Mm-hmm.
He dies in 1888. He invents something called the esteemed brain tonic and intellectual beverage. In 1886, this is 2 years
ago. This is going to turn out to be Tang, isn't it?
No. it could be, but no, this is about Coca-Cola and the invention of the formula of Coca-Cola.
Oh, of Coca-Cola. Okay.
Isn't that amazing?
Nice.
Yeah, one of those.
I like how all of these drinks started as like snake oil brain tonic to cure all that ails you.
Yes.
People were like, no, I'm still sick, but this is delicious.
It is, and maybe again it's coincidence, but also in 1947 is when there's the first reporting of the Roswell UFO. I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that Coca-Cola.
And 30 years later, Ron Stutz takes over on WCHL. Coincidence?
The
probably.
Rest is history,
but prove it.
Like that. Well, actually, this week is pretty significant because, you know, we think of, okay, the Declaration of Independence, Congress gets together. They all do, except New York abstains. And so it takes a few days. In fact, everything is finalized. July 2nd is when, of course, John Adams is saying, this is the date that will live in history because they vote for it. But actually, they finalize the language on July 4th. They don't sign it until August 2nd when people, you know, we think of all the signatures. That's when they do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's New York abstains, but it's on July 8th that finally the New York Convention says, no, we approve this. So they actually do. And because of that, then that day, that afternoon, is when George Washington has that copy read to the troops to say, this is what we're fighting for. But the first public reading was the day before on July 8th.
That's interesting because right around that same time, and I was thinking that this happened, and you might be able to shed some light on this. I was thinking this happened like right on July 4th, but if New York isn't ratifying until the 9th.
The 8th.
The 8th, right.
That's the first public reading. Well,
right.
So, it's it's the, let me get this the facts straight on this,
because it's at right around this time we're talking about this in the context of Silent Sam coming down last year, and I was doing some research on just statues, and there's that great story of after the independence is declared, New Yorkers in Lower Manhattan go and pull down the statue of King George, and I was thinking that happened on like the 4th or 5th or something, but I could be wrong about that.
It's actually July 8th is when the first public reading happens in Philadelphia. That's when they ring the what we call the Liberty Bell.
Right.
At that point, it's on the 9th that when New York actually does approve the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And so that's when George Washington has it read to his troops.
Gotcha.
So I just have the dates. I was so excited about these 2 days.
There's a lot going on. So yeah, Philadelphia is where the Declaration is written.
And
then first read outside later.
Right.
The Liberty Bell is rung.
Yes.
Someone says, crap, there's a crack. Go to New York real quick.
Well, they think actually that it did get damaged in the casting. They had a recast, and so it apparently rings okay then. And it's not until the early 19th century that a crack is discovered.
Okay.
And that's when they say, okay, we're going to have to hold off.
Maybe,
but they still
maybe don't
tap
ring
the
this
bell,
anymore.
Like when on June 6th, when the Allied forces, 1944, invaded France, the sound of the bell's dulled ring was broadcast by radio across the United
How
States.
How interesting.
Isn't that cool?
That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. I thought this is really cool. In fact, in 1777, out of fear that the British would take, when they were heading towards Philadelphia and would occupy it, they thought, if they get a hold of that bell, they'll melt it down to make it into cannon. Mm-hmm. So they actually hit it. And then they brought it back. So,
yeah.
And then it was returned to Philadelphia after the war in 1781, and then, which kind of quasi-served as the nation's capital between that and New York.
Right.
And then it was rung annually, and especially, I did not know this, to celebrate George Washington's birthday on February 22nd and the 4th of July.
Nice.
How cool is that?
Ringing it on D-Day is really cool. It's
it
also
is.
A very risky move at the time, because if they tap it and then it falls apart, that's a real bad omen.
Well, tapping. I mean, they were like, you know, let's really ring the bell. No, they're really tapping it. But even then, that would have been a profound issue. In fact, it was named the Liberty Bell in an 1839 poem. That's when it first gets its name, which is, this is all interesting.
And I've read about this recently, too. I think the Liberty Bell becomes the Liberty Bell as like an anti-slavery symbol, right?
Yes.
Is that? Yeah.
Yes,
like
that's right.
When it gets adopted by that movement, it's from there that we start thinking of it as this major symbol.
But you don't have to go to Philadelphia necessarily to see a replica. You can actually go into Raleigh and at the Museum of History, there in the plaza, there is a smaller replica outside that you can even ring if you want, but it's there. And also, now there's one kind of like this. It's not a duplicate, but in Hillsborough, in the downstairs of the old courthouse, you can see, and when it's open, you can actually go and, you know, hit it with your knuckles, an 1805 bell that used to hang there, which is really cool. We'll ring that, actually, on Bill of Rights Day.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just glorious to hear this old bell that's been ringing for, you know, 2 centuries. Like, wow.
Nice.
And not that long after all of the stuff that happens that establishes the Bill of Rights, which comes up this week. There is so much happening this week. I just don't even know. I just felt like a kid in a candy store. Like, oh, you thought the July 4th was great, the fireworks. No, this is so good. The 14th Amendment is ratified this week, 1868, guaranteeing, of course, African Americans full citizenship and all persons in the United States due process of law.
And that equal protection.
That becomes incredibly important across so many cases. Brown versus Board of Education, Roe versus Wade, Bush versus Gore, Reed versus Reed, gender discrimination, and racial quotas. It's just really remarkable how much that amendment has made a difference. And you know, that's something to really celebrate.
Speaking with Scott Washington, we got time for one more. What do you got?
One more. Oh, it's hard to say.
I know there's a lot. Yeah.
There are. Well, this is a week when Krispy Kreme donuts came into being, a recipe brought up from New Orleans, and our thoughts and prayers are with all the good folks in New Orleans who are facing a real deluge of water and storm down there this weekend. But supposedly this recipe comes out of New Orleans for yeast donuts. and it takes off. And the name came with it, which was Krispy Kreme, and the rest is history if you've ever had one or been in a line waiting to get one of those hot donuts, which is kind of fun. And it's just nice to know that there are people doing inventive things, sometimes in their own kitchens, and sometimes thinking up wonderful things that change our lives in such great ways, like amendments to the Constitution.
And there you go. That is History Matters for this week. As always, Scott Washington, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.